Hey, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of DFV. I'm your co-host, Black Cinephile.
And I'm your co-host, Brad.
Here's your co-host, Brad, over there. And on this one, folks, we got a nice double feature here of, kind of wacky sci-fi. Not necessarily quirky sci-fi, even though it kind of goes that lane sometimes, but kind of wacky sci-fi. We have Terry Gilliam's classic sci-fi thriller, 12 Monkeys. From 1995 versus Bong Joon-ho 2025 sci-fi film Mickey 17. And we got two of these movies here, man. I think two of these films like work well together because they both have a certain type of humor to them. One is a little bit more humorous than the other, but the sci-fi there, as well as like the wackiness behind the sci-fi, is efficient in both.
Oh yeah. Most surprising from this, I think, is the fact that you were the one that suggested this team up, because 12 Monkeys is directed by Terry Gilliam, one of the members of Monty Python, which is one of my favorite comedy groups out there in the UK. So the fact that you were like, hey, let's put up 12 Monkeys against Mickey 17. I was just like, yeah, absolutely. 100%. I have no... an excuse to go out of this one.
Yeah, and yeah, he is a member of Monty Python, and he's really a fantastic director.
He is.
When you look at this, when you look at this guy's history, like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Brazil, which Brazil is kind of more on the lane of 12 Monkeys. What's the one we watched? Time Bandits.
Yep.
He's a fantastic very diverse director, and this is a film that I had never saw before. We'll get into it, but I'd always heard about 12 Monkeys and how like it's like one of the great sci-fi films.
Yeah, 100%. For Terry Gilliam, he's one of those people that he knows how to do comedy. He knows how to do drama. He knows how to do like a good thriller story. All around, he's very talented in that regard. He was definitely like the Childish Gambino of, this era back then, where he just kind of was all over the place with different projects and everything. And everything kind of everybody was like, yeah, that was good. Yeah, that was also good. Oh, wait, he's going to do this now. OK, cool.
Yeah, he's a very interesting character. Maybe one day if we ever watch Brazil, I can tell you about a little bit of history behind that film and like marketing behind it and how they kind of got butchered a little bit when it was coming to theaters. But that's another story for another day. But yeah, man, I like that we got these two together. I feel like the characters, the main characters in 12 Monkeys and Mickey 17, almost kind of like parallel each other a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
You know how each film has like a subplot of romance. Each film has a main character that has a friend or ally that doesn't really turn out to be a friend or ally, but really like an enemy. There's a lot of parallels between these films for sure. But I'm ready to get into this, man. I feel like, I know we're going chronological here. I feel like we should do something new since we've been gone for a while. I feel like we should start off with 12 Monkeys. Just going in a new direction just for an episode.
You know what? Normally I would fight you on this one, but I do really want to talk about 12 Monkeys, so I'll let this one pass.
All right, cool. So we got 1995 12 Monkeys, directed by Terry Gilliam, based on the classic short film La Jetée from 1962 by Chris Marker. So this film stars Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, and Brad Pitt, also Christopher Plummer. Now, basically, Bruce Willis, he plays a man by the name of James Cole, who is living in 2035. He lives in an underground compound, and he is tasked with going back to 1996 to prevent the deadly virus that unleashed on the world in that year that wiped out almost all of humanity. Kind of the reason why he's living underground today. So by a group of scientists, he is sent back in time to find this original virus so we can so basically he can prevent the apocalypse from happening. There's a few screw ups. He's sent to the wrong year initially. Then again, and then he's sent to the right year, but the wrong part of the year. And it's just a bit of him just trying to figure out how the virus was planned. Along the way, he meets a psychologist, Dr. Catherine Riley, played by Madeline Stowe. And he meets a strange person in the mental hospital where he first ends up, Mr. Jeffrey Goins, played by Brad Pitt. And it's all about his journey of like trying to figure out who are the 12 monkeys, the organization that may or may not have unleashed this virus on the world. And that's the plot of 12 Monkeys, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always known about this film. And one of the main things I heard is that, you know, oh, Brad Pitt, this was like the performance that kind of like put him on the map. But like, I never really knew the plot of it. So I really walked into this one, like not knowing much, except I knew it was about time travel. I know people love Brad Pitt's performance in this one. And that's really all I knew. Going into this one, man, I mean, it's a Terry Gilliam film straight through. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's dark British comedy sprinkled throughout. There's like an imaginative world that's being put before you, a dystopian world. The production design is on point. Bruce Willis is a great lead in this one. This isn't a typical Bruce Willis lead film. You know, he's not as cocky or confident as like John McClane or, you know, his other action films. He's really lost in not knowing what's going on, but he knows he needs to do something. And this film gets a little dark, too. It definitely is a Terry Gilliam film all the way. And I like this one, man.
Yeah, this is one that I had seen long ago, probably like a decade ago or so, back when I was like in a kick for watching basically everything from Monty Python and what they did afterwards and everything like that. And I vaguely remembered parts of this movie, and some parts of it I did not remember at all. Like I knew the basic plot of it overall, and I remembered a couple jokes, like the joke about like when he's going back in time and everything and he keeps going back to the wrong time. Like, I remembered that joke in it. And I love how like even one part where he comes back to 2035 and he's talking to one of the other inmates and they're just like, time travel isn't an exact science with these scientist folk, you know, just be lucky you didn't get sent back to the prehistoric era or you even landed on Earth in the first place. And it's just kind of one of those funny things where they're just throwing, you know, everything at the wall and hoping that something sticks, because you find out that they're also doing this to other inmates and they're also being just sent to random points in time trying to figure this out, because we find out one of them gets sent to World War One, which is the same time that, you know, James Cole is sent to, and he gets killed in World War One. As a result of just ending up in some kind of camp or something like that, where they had just bombed it or something had happened. And when they're going through like everything, they find James Cole and one other guy that survived it who had appeared in time after the bombing. And all the soldiers there are like, what is going on? How do you have two survivors? You guys look like in immaculate condition. What is going on here?
Right. Yeah, it's funny, and I like the way the film plays with time travel. You know, when he initially gets sent back, you know, it's 1990, and you know he's in holding by the police, and you know that's where we first meet you know Dr. Riley who meets him, and she's like you know he's all tied up in the police station. One of the cops is like he tried to fight all of us off, like, you know, be careful in there. And she's like, yo, I'll be all right, thank you. And, you know, the whole time he's like, I got to get out of here. I got to stop the virus. And, you know, to any normal person walking the street, you're like, all right, this guy's a little nuts. But I like their dynamic and how, you know, of course, she's the kind of doctor that wants to understand what's going on with him. Of course, she thinks he's clinically insane, but she wants to understand the root of trauma or whatever, not knowing that this is actually a guy from the future. So he gets in the mental hospital, but I like when we first meet Brad Pitt, right? You know, he's just this guy like that's in the mental hospital that's, you know, kind of showing James Cole around, right? He's very kooky, he's nervous, he's fidgety, and then as the film goes on, we start to realize, no, this guy is kind of like a little bit more important to the plot, meaning that his father is like a renowned doctor, a renowned like a scientist. And then you start to realize, why is he even in here in the first place? Because he keeps saying, my father finds out about this, you know, I'm going to be released out of here. Mm-hmm. And I like how if you walk into this movie not knowing anything about it and you're patient with it, I like how the film like gives you more and more clues as to what's really going on.
Right. Yeah, because with James's like constant time travel and everything like that, I love how they do slowly give you a little bit more information. Like they pick James, or James thinks that he was picked as one of the people because he has a really good memory. In reality, they're basically just throwing any inmate that they can find into this time machine and seeing if they can get a better result than the last one that never came back. And we slowly find out that kind of information. Then we slowly find out, you know, that they expected these inmates to be able to communicate them by calling a phone number that was going to be inactive in 1996, and thus they would be able to send it to a voicemail for that right. number, and they could listen in on that. And they end up getting some weird kind of like voicemails sent to that box that they interpret to mean like, oh, we found who is behind this, the 12 monkeys, we gotta go back and figure it out. In reality, it's just garbled mess because of their time stream kind of interference that means absolutely nothing whatsoever. And I love how we slowly find that out and everything. Then you also have, as you mentioned, Brad Pitt's character of Jeffrey Goines, who continually pops up every time James is going to a different era, from like 1990 to 1996. And he becomes like a more prolific figure in this movie, especially when he comes back to 1996 and he talks to James again for the first time. He's like, as one of the 12 monkeys, or when he's searching for the 12 monkeys, and he runs into Jeff again, and they start talking and everything in like this secret hideout. And he's just like, dude, what are you talking about? You're the one that came up with this idea. This was all you, man. You, back when we were in that asylum together and everything, you gave me the idea that we could do this.
Which is crazy work. Yeah, I love that. I love the way the plot unfurls here, you know, and I love how throughout we have that, you know, that dream that that Cole keeps having, where, you know, you think the guy kind of looks like Brad Pitt, but then it doesn't look like Brad Pitt. And then the woman that's following him, we don't know what she looks like. And then we get cut further and further there, and then we realize what's going on. So I like how the film plays with time. I like how the film plays with interpretation. And I got to say, the performances here, everybody does like a great job. Like Bruce Willis, he strikes you as a guy that's dangerous, but he's also vulnerable. And there's a certain point in the film where he doesn't know whether the future is really the present or whether he's really crazy or not. He doesn't know what's going on. And I feel like Bruce Willis sells that perfectly.
Oh, yeah.
Brad Pitt is dangerous and really insane. And he sells that perfectly, you know, just like his jitteriness, like his cadence of speech. Like this, I can see how this is a performance that actually put him on the map here. Madeline Stowe, you know, she's great like that, like starting out as this doctor that's like very assured in her position. You know, she wants to help patients. She wants to help patients get better. And then she even starts to question her sanity. Like, wait a minute. This guy that's a loon that kind of kidnapped me, is he for real? Is this something that's actually going to happen? And she starts to question her sanity. A lot of people in this film question their sanity. And yeah. I like how it plays around with that for sure.
Well, I love how Catherine Raley, how she finally gets her like moment of, I guess, truth in the whole matter when she like takes the bullet that James was shot with when he was transported back to World War One. And she gets it like tested and everything like that. And it comes back and they're just like, this is an ancient relic and it's in like pristine condition. Like this is from 1920s. And, you know, where did you get this? And she's just like, don't worry about it. And she just kind of hangs up. And the next time she sees James, she's like, no, I believe you now. But this is when James is like, no, you were right. I'm absolutely insane. There's no time travel. I'm not doing anything. This is the present. I'm just going crazy here. I need help. I need psychiatric help. And she's like, I believe you now. You know, you're right. I have proof that you're right about this. We got to stop this. And she starts actually falling in line, because up till then, I love how James just pops out of reality as far as she's concerned. Like in 1990, he's like strapped to a bed in like a sealed off room with, you know, 20-foot high ceilings, and he just disappears from the room. And everybody's just like, so you're telling me this guy that was strapped down to the bed without an inch of movement somehow unstrapped himself, climbed up these walls and up into that ventilation shaft that's 12 inches by 12 inches and escaped this room? And everybody's just kind of silent. And then it just pans back to like 2035, where James is being questioned by the scientists. And he's just like, what is going on? Why did you bring me back?
Yeah. It's interesting, because I like how the film plays. We never see him really disappear. It always happens off screen,
right?
Which like, kind of like messes with the film's perception. Like, well, is he really from the future or is he insane? Mm-hmm. Like, I like how the direction kind of like even plays tricks on you.
Right. Yeah. It holds its cards close to its hand until like that pivotal moment where she gets like the bullet tested, and then he reappears once more. And it starts going like, okay, no, he is actually traveling, at least it seemingly, through time. Whether what else is going on is up for debate. But then they kind of just buckle down and they start trying to figure out this mystery before kind of going, you know what? We're just going to fly off and we're going to just have the rest of our lives ahead of us until this virus takes over the world, because there's nothing we can do now. And I love how they, when they're like in the cop car, or not the cop car, the taxi car, like heading to the airport, they like hear over the radio and they about like the zoo that had all of its animals kind of let go and all this other stuff going on. And it's all caused by the 12 monkeys. And they're just like, oh, that's the 12 monkeys. They had nothing to do with the virus. They were just a activist group that released all these animals from the zoo in order to like stop animal testing kind of stuff, like to protest that kind of that environmental kind of issue and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just, I love how, they're just revealed as loons in the end.
Right.
Like, oh, they want to free all the animals. Like, I love that parallel of like, you know, the animals running around. And then when Bruce Willis is originally, when he originally goes to like the future of the world, you know, there's that bear that's walking around that kind of like, you know, roars at him. Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. He's like, oh, the guy was just crazy in the end. That's all it was.
Right.
And I like how in the end, which really pays homage to the short film I told you about, The La Jetée, that kind of like, you know, inspired this movie. I like how in the end we realized that the guy that got shot in Cole's dreams was actually Cole, because he was trying to stop the man that had taken the virus and unleashed it onto the world, who actually worked for Brad Pitt's character's father. Perfect level of creepiness by David Morse, by the way, who plays the guy. I like how he's getting his bag checked by TSA, and they're like, oh, what is this thing? Oh, you know, it's a potion. It's great. It has no odor. He tries to get him to smell it. That's not necessary, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you don't get any red flags from this creepy guy. Like,
this was 90s airport vibe. You know, nobody was creepy. It was just like, you know what? Get out of my state.
Like, just get out of here, man. Just take your weird
potions and leave. Get on the plane and go wherever you're going.
Which is hilarious to me. But I like how you got young Cole that sees his older self get shot. It's a very powerful moment. And then you see Madeline Stowe kind of stare at the young boy. And what I like is when they get on the plane, right? And, you know, this line has been up for interpretation, like, because I tried looking it up, like, what did this character mean by this? You see one of the scientists from the future on the plane with the guy. And she's like, man, you know, animals being released in the streets, you know, all types of crazy stuff happening. You would think humans are about to become extinct. And the other guy goes, oh, I think you're right, ma'am. She goes, yeah, I'm in insurance. So some people have taken that, like, interpret that line of, like, maybe she was there to make sure that the virus does still happen, even though they told Bruce Willis they sent him back to stop the virus from happening. Or maybe she, at some point, stopped the virus from happening since Bruce Willis couldn't do it himself. Like, it's a line that's, like, up for interpretation.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that I remember people talking about this before, because they use everything about her being there as a way to form both opinions, where the first one is obviously she's there to stop the virus. She's the insurance to guarantee that he can fulfill his mission now that they have the information from Bruce Willis the last time he sent it, because he sends one final, like, voicemail to them. And Goines originally basically mocks him, being like, they're not going to get your message, man. It's gone. You know, it was a good try, but it's not going to happen. But there's a possibility they did get it, and she's the insurance to make sure it stops now that they got that voicemail. The second one is she is actually against the scientists in the future and wants the virus to happen so she can get her, like, experimentation going for all this other stuff underground. And she's the insurance that she gets that power. She gets that ability to go through that scientific stuff by making sure the virus does happen, so humanity is kind of thrown underground. And I've seen both arguments. I don't know which one's right. I think the funnier one is she's the insurance to stop the virus now, just because it seems just a funnier outcome of they tried to, like, stop that voicemail. It actually does go through, and she is actually the backup plan to make sure that it does stop for real this time. It also gives the movie a more lighthearted ending instead of being like, no, no, everything failed.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. You know, it's an interesting interpretation, but I like it, man. You know, it ends on a kind of a downer ending, like typical of Gilliam, but it constructs itself very well by the end. I wasn't left going, dude, what was that? Like Time Bandits, where I was right. Like, this was supposed to be made for kids. But I went like, okay, this fits the film. This ending fits.
Yeah. Nobody's house exploded with their parents dead and them just kind of out on the sidewalk with a zoom out, you know? Sure. Cole did see himself get shot. You know, his future self get killed as a child. Yeah, okay, that's Terry Gilliam dark humor right there. We get it. But at the very least, that's pretty tame when compared to, like, Time Bandits ending.
Yeah. It is pretty tame. But I think it fits the ending well. Mm-hmm. You know, some of it is a little bit of a mess, but I think it's a very strong sci-fi film. It definitely deserves the praise it gets. I would give it a 4.5.
Yeah, I have this one as a 4 out of 5, in my opinion. Strong performances from everybody in this. You know, Bruce Willis, Brad Pitt, Madeline Stowe, even like the supporting cast and all this. Very good work here. The plot is fun. It's an interesting kind of look at time travel. I don't think there's really been anything that's kind of done something similar to this since, really, in the regards of, like, the dystopia, like, throwing somebody back in time and kind of continually screwing it up kind of situation. Normally, movies like this have, like, the closing where they succeed. This one, it's kind of left ambiguous as to whether it was a success or not. Kind of alluding that it was not a success. And it's got the Terry Gilliam humor, and I like that.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you, man. I think it's a great film for sure. Yeah, man. With that being said, we're going to move on to the next one here.
Which brings us to Mickey 17, directed by Bong Joon-ho, and following his directorial Oscar win of Parasite, we have his latest movie released in 2025. We have Mickey Barnes, who is a employee of a company that has done a cloning experiment in order to create an expendable person. And as such, Mickey is one of the people that has opted to take this position in order to help the furtherment of mankind as they go to a brand new planet known as Niflheim. On this planet, Mickey takes on basically every dangerous task that is given to him in order to continue mankind and everything like that, including taking on a virus in order to help create a vaccine for it, which causes most of his deaths early on in the movie, as well as basically the scientists just using him as an experimental body for everything that they can think of, since he's considered an expendable. But we start the story on the 17th iteration of Mickey, known as Mickey 17, who has been trapped in a hole after being caught in an avalanche of sorts when trying to find creatures on the planet Niflheim that are seen as a threat. But after Mickey 17 is declared dead on arrival on the planet's surface, they create a new Mickey, Mickey 18, but Mickey 17, not being dead, ends up coming back to the ship to find this new Mickey, causing an entire situation where the two need to figure out how to coexist in this world where there should only be one of them, knowing that they had to keep this secret, and having a couple other characters along the way that help them along with this, such as Nasha, played by Naomi Ackie, who acts as love interest for Mickey and has always kind of been there through all his iterations of life and death, and is very keen to keeping his secret and making sure that both of these Mickeys can exist, considering all the torment that he went through with his previous 16 iterations. Mark Ruffalo plays Kenneth Marshall, the politician that owns the ship and is basically the maniacal mastermind behind the entire operation, trying to create this new world and control it to his demands. And then Steven Yeun playing Timo, one of Mickey's friends from Earth that originally got him in the trouble that set him on this course in the first place. That's the basic of this plot, where we basically just see Mickey 17, the 17th Mickey, expendable version, kind of going through this situation where he should be dead, he is still alive, and now he's got the choice to try and figure out how he can survive on this ship without getting caught with Mickey 18, who is a much more aggressive version of himself, and just all the chaos that ensues by the fact that there's two of them now.
Yeah, it's it's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah,
but you know, I like how you know two things work throughout this movie that keep you engaged. Of course, you know Bong Joon-ho's direction and how he navigates science fiction and comedy, which is something he does pretty well when you look throughout his filmography. Like even before Parasite, he knows how to like you know travel between genres well. And mixed genres well, and Robert Pattinson's like performance. I think he nails it out of the park in this one here, because Mickey 17 himself is pathetic. You know, he's lovable, but he's a little pathetic. You know what I mean? He's kind of an idiot, but he's got a heart of gold, and you know, it's hard to hate the guy. And when your whole life is being put through death after death after death for the sake of science, you know, you can either go very cynical or you could just take life as, hey, it is what it is, you know, and I feel like he's more on like the latter. And then when you got the new Mickey that's very aggressive and angry, you know, that's where like Patterson's like performance really shines. It feels over the top, but par of the course, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I like how they kind of push that each Mickey does have its own personality as it comes out. Like, it's the cloning process isn't an exact science kind of thing. That these are still technically different people, even though they have all the same memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's definitely an interesting character for sure. I like the romance dynamic between him and Naomi Ackie's character, who is fantastic in this as Nasha. And you know, the friendship dynamic between him and Timo, you know, is kind of similar to the dynamic between, you know, Cole and Brad Pitt's character in 12 Monkeys, as you know, Timo is obviously like one of the worst friends ever. But you know, he's the reason why Mickey like was even like in this situation. And I like how he keeps popping up throughout the film. It's kind of like that bad friend that makes things worse. So I like that dynamic. And you know, I love the over the topness of this movie, man. Like Mark Ruffalo as Kenneth Marshall, like just someone who's an egomaniac, too close to someone we know of in real life.
Yeah.
Kind of a mix of them, really. And it's a performance that's on the nose, but this is an on the nose kind of movie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, 100%. Like it, Mark Ruffalo definitely goes all in on just pure evil on this one. Like one of the scenes where Mickey was invited to have dinner with Kenneth Marshall and Yelfa Marshall, his wife, and during this dinner, you know, Mickey is eating the food that they give him because it's like the best food that he's ever been given as a expendable and everything, because it was somebody had passed away and they were kind of just like mourning that person's passing by like giving Mickey and someone else. I can't remember her name right now. But as one of the one of the security agents that knew this other person, and kind of giving them a moment of like to grieve this person's death, which I think is ironic that Mickey is there, considering Mickey has died several times and his entire thought is he's an expendable. He's a meat puppet for us to kill off. He means nothing. Right. But this other person, that was sad that this other person died. And it's even exemplified right by the fact that during that dinner, Mickey gets like poisoned by the lab grown meat that they were giving him. And so he's like in incredible pain. And Kenneth's solution is taking out a gun and just putting it to Mickey's head and being like, well, maybe the next one will have better luck, and is ready to shoot him. And it's just like, it's such an evil response to everything going on. I love how like Kai even comes in. It's like, wait a minute, we're here to mourn somebody and you're ready to like kill another. And I like how Yulfa like chimes in. She's like, yeah, don't you dare do that. That is a Persian rug you're on right now. You do not blow a hole in that right now and destroy that rug. You know, that right is worth a fortune. And Ken's response is, okay, well, hold on. Well, what if I do it through the side so it doesn't put a hole and get the blood all over it, you monster? And I love how that one scene kind of sums up everything messed up about this movie and the entirety of like its plot and what it's going for, where they only mourn people when it is something that they can use for themselves, mostly because the security agent was somebody that was close to that person. They also use it as a way to test new lab-grown meat on Mickey. Again, another experiment on him that he just doesn't realize is happening. When it goes wrong, they're ready to just off him like any other cattle that they see him as, even though they're ironically at a mourning period for somebody else when they're ready to just off him off. And then you have the audacity of them just being more worried about the rug than of this person they're about to kill. It just sums up everything about this movie in that scene so perfectly, and I love it.
Yeah, it's definitely a film about class, you know, classism, and Basically, using technology for malicious means. It's definitely a clear satire here. But I like how the film, it throws everything at the wall, and it doesn't let up. I feel like if you're gonna do a movie like this, you either do it subtle or you do it where you're throwing everything at the wall. 12 Monkeys, as somber as it was, it did throw everything at the wall. And just like that's why I feel like it's a nice comparison with this film because it's both over the top wacky sci-fi, but they both have heart and soul to them. I like the dynamic between Mickey 17 and Mickey 18, where Mickey 18 is just a straight up psychopath that's like, let's kill him. That's like his number one go-to solution. Like, let's kill him. Like if somebody's in our way, just kill them. And Mickey 17 is like, dude, you can't just kill everybody. You know what I mean? You gotta find some type of balance. So I like the dynamic between the two of them. The one scene where Nasha has like a fantasy of like being with the both of them gets a little weird.
Oh,
But again, I think it's par of course for a movie like this.
yeah, because when 17 shows up, she's already with Mickey 18, and she's just like, oh my God, there's two of you now? Oh, this is amazing. And I love how Mickey, like 17's like, how are you not like freaked out by this? And she's just like, oh, if there were two of me, you would be excited too. Don't lie. And immediately, I love how they have the kind of like weird love. I guess it's a love square with Kai coming in as well, who was trying to get with Mickey 17 prior to this. And upon learning that there's two, is like, well, we can share them. I get 17, you get 18, everybody's happy. And Nasha's just like, no, they're both Mickey, my Mickey. I've been with Mickey this entire time. They both belong to me. Again, showing the whole thing where she also sees Mickey as just an object in some regard with all his death and doesn't really see him as a person anymore in a way, which again goes to show the entire like concept of this movie of just like the expendable person is just nothing to no one.
It's pretty funny. When you got that, I like the dynamic that that Mickey of course has with the creepers too. Like, and I like how the film, manipulates emotion, right? Like when one of the creepers dies or when a creeper dies on screen, you feel it because even though the creature is ugly, it's still a living thing. And everyone else goes like, "Oh, kill it. Kill it. It's a monster." The film manipulates emotion well. It kind of like brings you back to its theme of like, life is life, no matter like how different it may be. I like the whole sound design with the creepers. Like when Mickey 17 is out there trying to talk to them, I like how they talk to each other and like the sound design behind that.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing because the creepers are kind of like set out as these monsters to everybody, but they saved Mickey 17 initially when he was in that avalanche, like stuck underground. They brought him back to the surface and allowed him to return back to his ship. And even when like one of their own was killed on the ship, and they come back to like get the second one that is kind of being held captive. They're still somewhat, I want to say reasonable in their demands, where they're just like, bring us the baby, and you killed one of yours, we get to, or you killed one of ours, we get to kill one of yours, an eye for an eye kind of thing. And it's like, okay. They're smart species here, which we find out a little bit more about them down the end of the movie as well. But I love that kind of like interaction that he has with them. Also, the fact that who was it? I think it was Ken the Yilfa that finds out that the tails of these creatures are delicious. And she wants to eat them, so she sends out the Mickeys to like go gather all their tails And when they're like walking around these, I heard little comment of just like, they're walking over all those precious tails right there. They could be grabbing. What are they doing? They're not even trying.
Yeah, I know, right? It's pretty funny. Yeah, they're like caricatures of evil, but they like Tony and Mark play it so well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I like this one, man. I mean, I don't really like I have much else to add. I mean, I like how Timo, like, even in the end, like, he still doesn't get his just due as a villain the whole film. He still like gets by the hair on his head by killing the Lone Shark associate, but like twisting in self defense and testifying against the Lone Shark in trial. And it's like, this guy has like the luck of fools, like getting away in multiple times in the movie. But I like the resolution of everything. You know what I mean? I like the bad dream Mickey 17 has at one point with the cloning machine. Like the fake out. But overall, man, I think this is a pretty good sci-fi comedy. I think Robert Pattinson's performance knocks it out of the park. Boon Jung, Jun Ho, you know, does a great job with direction. I know how some people, you know, when you're coming off a massively successful film like Parasite, people expect something to be like on the same level, either plot wise or acclaim wise. But I don't feel like this was a bad follow-up movie.
Right.
I feel like it was, you know, Bong Joon-ho swinging for the fences like he's done with every movie he's in his filmography, including Parasite. It's just on a different wavelength, you know. But overall, I think the film does what it does well. I give it a... I got this at a strong 3.5, though.
Okay. Yeah, I have to agree with you on a lot of that. When it comes to Bong Joon-ho, Parasite was just a swing and a home run for his stuff.
Right.
If you look at his previous kind of, I guess, filmography, he takes swings all the time at different kind of concepts, different stories and everything like that. And they're not all hits. But Mickey 17 is one of those ones where it's not Parasite level, but it's still good. It's not a bad movie. There are some criticisms that I had heard, especially regarding the fact that it's based off the book Mickey 7. And it strays from the book quite a lot when it comes to its story and everything like that. Like, generally, the theme is still there that, you know, from that original story. But the overall story itself is completely rewritten, more or less. And there's a couple things, like Bong Joon-ho was asked, like, why Mickey 17 instead of Mickey 7? And his response is, well, I just wanted to kill Mickey 10 more times. And it's like, okay, that sounds interesting. But then those 10 additional times are just all done off screen anyway, really. Or they're just very quick, like, oh, we threw him out into space to see what would happen if, you know, we threw one of the bodies out into space kind of thing. We decided to do this with it. And it's like, I kind of wish you would have done more with it when you were like, oh, I wanted to kill him 10 more times. Like, okay, but do something more with those 10 more times. It doesn't need to be just quick flashback moments of just 10 more excruciating deaths for him. But overall, it is still an enjoyable movie. I haven't read the book, so I can't say from a perspective of book to movie where... That seems to be the biggest criticism most people had, was it's nothing like the book, and people were hoping to finally get this book adapted into a movie because they love that book. So I have it as a 3.5, same as with you. The issues that I heard about this movie aren't ones that really affected me too much. It does get a little over the top at times with some of its dialogue and everything.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, okay, you guys are talking about the same thing for like 10 minutes here. Like the scene where Timo is like talking to Mickey 17, 18 and Nasha about, well, I the Lone Shark says he's got a guy here. I got to do this and everything. And it's like that scene just goes on for way too long. You know,
yeah.
I don't know how long that scene is, but it felt like 30 minutes.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. It could have been wrapped up a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of moments like that in the movie. And like I said, it's a wild ride, and it does what it does well. It's not the best wacky comedic sci-fi film I've ever seen, but it does what it does well. I appreciated it for what it was, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah, man, I think that pretty much says it. 12 Monkeys wins out here. You know, definitely a strong film. Definitely a film that deserves its acclaim and its legacy. And yeah, man, with that being said, you know, heading into after show here, it's been some time since we talked. I'm in FYC season, so I have seen a lot of things, but I don't want to, you know, bombard your head with everything I've seen. But, you know, there was one something very special I went to go see that means a
Okay.
lot to me recently. Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair.
Yep.
Now, before I get into this, let me say this. You know, I may love the art. The artist kind of gets is a different story. The artist kind of gets on my nerves. We know Paul Dano and Matthew Lillard can act. We ain't even gonna get into this debate here. Like, did you hold on? You've been in China. Did you hear about what happened?
I did not hear about what happened.
So Quentin Tarantino made some comments about actors he thinks are horrible, and Paul Dano was on the list. And almost everybody on Twitter or social spaces that knows about cinema or just cares about cinema basically came out and said F you to Quentin Tarantino. Because, like, he had made a comment, and I know Quentin Tarantino feeds off controversy. This is how he is in interviews. He always says wacky things. I
Right.
get it. It's to sell the movie. I understand. But he crossed the line. You don't touch Paul Dano when it comes to performances in cinema. This dude said that Paul Dano was weak and there will be blood, and you know, why was he even in the movie? And everybody just kind of came out and said, "Dude, you suck." I mean, everybody. Like, you know, Michael Cera posted a picture of him and him and Paul Dano, and he basically just put the caption, "Yeah, F Quentin Tarantino." Like, he just got like slammed online for saying Paul Dano was a horrible actor. So, and then he tried to make a comment. I think Matthew Lillard said something about Quentin Tarantino thought he was a bad actor. And then, you know, that's Scooby.
Yeah.
No, that's Shaggy. You know, people got even more upset. And then Quentin Tarantino kept getting clowned more on social media. Like, how dare you go after Matthew Lillard? Like, you know, yeah, so that's what happened. But anyway, Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair. We're gonna talk about the art here. Man, fantastic. I mean, you know I love this movie. It's my favorite film, and I've always counted them both as one. Seeing them together here in one with an extended anime sequence for the origin of Oren Ishii, for her chapter. Like, the anime is extended, like showing like a little bit more of her journey after like avenging her father. And there's an intermission in between, and the fighting scene is in color. It's no longer in black and white. The story behind that is they didn't want to get an NC-17 rating, so they made the Crazy 88 fighting scene black and white initially, but now it's in color. Dude, seeing the whole thing as one complete film, it's amazing. I'm sure it's still, is it still playing where you are?
It might be. I'll have to double check and see. Because I know that was a limited time theater kind of event, especially because it
Right.
takes up like a block of like 4.5 hours or something like that
Oh
for the
yeah,
whole
it's
thing.
4+ hours, man. Even
Yeah.
with the intermission, it's 4+ hours. But the film, because it's an action film, because it's a film that definitely has a lot of dramatic weight to it, especially in the second volume, it goes by fast, especially if you love the movie. Like, for
Right.
me, it didn't feel like 4.5 hours, you know, because I love that movie. But it's very good, man. You know, there's an intermission in between, give you a break, go to the bathroom, whatever have you. Yeah, the whole thing flows well. I didn't think in my lifetime I would see The Whole Bloody Affair, like really one and two pushed together in cinema. And I'm very grateful for the experience. Tarantino says it won't come out on release. I doubt it. I think Lionsgate at some point will find a way to release it to like one complete version. You don't have to rely on fan edits, which fan edits, there's been some pretty good fan edits out there. I think I told you about some of them.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, man, I would highly recommend it. If you love the movie, you don't even have to love it as much as I do. Even if you like Kill Bill, it's a great experience seeing one and two patched together.
Right. I know that there's been, well, as you said, there's been a lot of fan edits and everything like that. There's also been a lot of like re-releases of, but still separated out of just like the pinnacle version of Kill Bill Volume 1, the pinnacle version of Kill Bill Volume 2 that you could watch back to back. So them actually finally splicing the two movies together, do they actually have anything that kind of in this special version that intersects the two movies, like between them a little bit more, or does it pretty much just hypercut from one to two?
So there's no cliffhanger at the end of Volume 1 where, you know, where Bill says, does she know her daughter's still alive? They cut that part out. So that's a complete surprise when the daughter shows up at the end.
Okay.
I mean, if you've seen the movies, you know the daughter's still alive.
But right.
Let's say if this is my first time ever seeing Kill Bill, and then you see the daughter in the end, you go, oh my goodness, the daughter's still alive. It adds more dramatic weight to that moment. So like that's it. So it pretty much like cuts where you know, she tells Sophie in the back of the trunk, oh, well, I'm coming after them. And then it cuts right there, intermission. Starts right off with the wedding flashback. The wedding reception flashback. So yeah.
Okay, so it cuts basically the last, like, what is that? Maybe like 2 minutes or so from Volume 1.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, if I can't catch it in theaters, it'll be one of those ones that it's like, yeah, pick it up on Blu-ray. Because I do like Kill Bill. I thought those were great movies and everything like that. So seeing them like finally cut together as Tarantino originally had envisioned it before he realized that he was making a 4-hour movie and had to go, hold on, I think I got to cut this one in half here.
Right, right. I mean, look, I'll say this, and I will say this to the artist, Quentin Tarantino, as far as his art goes. You know, he does swing for the fences, and he is a guy that loves cinema. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Grindhouse, for example, like him and his film and Robert Rodriguez's film, that's a long movie with their films patched together. So yeah. I could see how in his mind, he's like, well, this is doable, but, you know, from the studio side, mindset, they're like, we're not making people sit through a 4-hour movie. I get it from a business standpoint, their side. But yeah, I'm glad that it's finally patched together here in one complete film. And I think Lionsgate will release it. I know Tarantino said it's not going to be released, but I think they'll release it.
It'll probably be a year or so, or they'll wait until the next like anniversary for Kill Bill Volume 1 or 2 in order to be like, hey, this is the X year anniversary for this movie, and we're releasing the full final edition, you know, the whole Bloody Affair cut on Blu-ray to celebrate. I can see that. But the fact that right now the theater is at its like weakest point is probably helping to make it so they could go, hey, we want to release this 4-hour cut of a movie that you'll literally only be able to play twice a day in any movie theater across, you know, the United States here. We want to release that in theaters. And for theaters to go, yeah, we have an empty theater. We can put that in now.
It was a full theater, the one I was in, man.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah, and I didn't expect it either, because when I first got my ticket, it was like, oh, it's not that full in here. Then I came in, it was like, wow, this is really full. And it was some people in there that had never seen the movie before. Like, during the intermission, I heard one woman go, so does she kill Bill? I mean, is she going to kill him at the end of this? This is a 4-hour movie. And he goes, just wait for it. I mean, I imagine she is. She's killing everybody else. Like,
right.
Like, I thought that was a funny conversation.
Oh, that's clearly a fan of the movie brought their girlfriend to go see it, you know, kind of situation.
Right, right, for sure. I wish I could have took my wife to see this film, but she's seen one and two already. But I wish I could have took her to see this and have this be her first experience seeing this film like this.
Right.
But yeah, for sure. Initially when she saw the runtime, she said 4 hours. I'm okay. I'll watch it at home.
Right. I'm all good.
Right, right. What did you check out, man? I know you probably checked out something.
So I've caught a couple movies, a lot of like older ones recently, just on TV and everything like that, as I was kind of like sitting in hotel rooms. But one big one that I finally watched because it was on the airplane while I was traveling was Roofman.
Okay.
Which, I'll be honest, pretty decent movie. It has some fun parts with it. And it, for anybody that doesn't know, Roofman follows the real story of a ex-military kind of person that had fallen on bad luck and as a result started robbing McDonald's across several states by drilling through the roof and jumping into the building by then and then waiting for employees to show up so he could rob the registers and everything from the safe and make an escape. And it made news mostly because it was the same kind of thing happening at multiple McDonald's locations across multiple states. All of the people that like worked at McDonald's always said that he was a very nice person, that he apologized for doing this, that, you know, he would make sure that they would be put into like the freezer, but he'd make sure that they all had their jacket before he'd put them in the freezer so they weren't too cold kind of thing. And so it made a lot of like headlines around the time because it was this thing that had happened where people were like, yeah, we got robbed, but, you know, he was a nice guy. Which isn't a headline that happens very often. So when he was caught and everything like that, he spent some time in jail before managing to escape. And after escaping, he ended up living in a Toys R Us and a Circuit City for a year. The movie only does a Toys R Us, mostly because I think they tried to incorporate the Circuit City stuff. It would be too long of a runtime, and there's just not enough story there for it to be interesting, I believe, considering it was literally a year of him just hiding in a store, not really doing too much. So the fact that they already had enough to fill out like an hour and a half of time on this was kind of impressive. But Channing Tatum as the lead role in this one, absolutely fantastic. It's a fun movie. It's nothing that's going to make you walk away and be like, man, this is cinema. But you're going to walk away going, yeah, that was fun.
It definitely was a fun movie. I catch that one, too. Channing Tatum, that was a great performance by him because it leaned into his comedic skills. It leaned into his kind of like his dramatic skills, too. It was
his
a nice
charismatic
mix
skills.
His charisma. Yeah. I like the chemistry between him and Kirsten Dunst. I thought she was pretty good in it, too. Peter Dinklage was good. He was a great asshole. Like, yes. You know, it was a solid movie. I enjoyed it too.
Yeah. I do think it's funny because one of the things that after this movie came out, one of the employees from the Toys R Us did a Q&A online of like people asking because interest in this story like skyrocketed when this movie came out. So he was like, yeah, I was actually working at the Toys R Us at the time. And answered a couple questions. And one of his comments was, I kind of find it ironic that they got Kirsten Dunst to play his love interest in this, because one of the movies that he apparently had in the hideaway to watch during like the on hours and everything was Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man 2. Ah, that's hilarious. That's hilarious.
Yeah, in the real events, he was watching Spider-Man 2. And in the movie version of those events, Kirsten Dunst, who was Mary Jane in Spider-Man 2 plays the love interest of him in this movie.
That's hilarious.
Absolutely a perfect, like, I don't know if they did that on purpose or if it just happened that Kirsten Dunst auditioned for the role and they were just like, yeah, you get it. And then I don't even know if anybody on like the movie set realized that detail about it either.
Right.
It might just be a happy coincidence kind of situation.
It might be. It might be. Cool, man. I'm glad you checked out Roofman, dude. What else did you check out?
Beyond that, I checked out just a couple just random movies. I'm trying to remember which ones. But it was just kind of like the, oh, this is on TV on the English channel. Sure. Oh. I'll have this play on in the background. But other than that, it was catching up on Smiling Friends finished its third season, I think this was. Fantastic show. Absolutely love that one. Catching up on the new season of Has Been Hotel. Again, pretty fun show. It just a couple things like that. Pluribus, I don't know if you've watched that at all, the new Vince Gillian.
I want to watch it. I'm waiting for it to end.
Okay.
But I heard it's terrific.
Yeah, I've seen the first couple episodes of that. I got to catch up on the most recent episodes. But that one's an interesting take on that story.
Yeah, I heard it. Really, I heard it is a great show. Like, you know, I've been seeing like, you know, kind of like the review blurbs, like up to like the latest episode. And they say this is a pretty good show.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, good, good. Because I want him to make something. Now, I don't mind staying in the Breaking Bad universe. Don't get me wrong. But I know I want to see Vince Gilligan make something outside of like, you know, the Breaking Bad universe. And they say like this is a good kind of like deterrent from that.
Yeah, this is his break into doing something sci-fi, and I think he's doing it right.
Well, you know, he comes from the X-Files. He used to be a writer on that show.
Right, but coming back to sci-fi after doing more of, like, reality drama with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
I got you. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah, man, absolutely. I am looking forward to getting into that show. Yeah, man. Well, I want to say, man, you know, this has been a great episode of DFV, y'all. You know, we will catch you on the next one. You let us know which film you think wins out here. And yeah, take care.